today is competitive strategy. We spent a little time in the first 2 weeks introducing the subject, talking a little bit about demand, and then about production and cost. So today we're going to talk about a firm's strategy. What is strategy? How do firms, how do they strategize to achieve their objectives? And most importantly, how do principles from the Austrian school help us to understand business strategy a little bit better? Now, strategy is a very broad concept. And if you go into your local bookstore, you can find lots and lots of books, some academic books, and lots of guru-type books on strategy as well as leadership and similar subjects. You know, we're going to be taking a little bit more of an academic approach here. And there's been quite a lot of academic writing on business strategy. And I'll try to draw on some of that writing here. Uh-oh, I've dropped out of the slides. Have dropped out again. What could be happening here?
Connection was lost. I think it's the Wi-Fi thing again.
Should I refresh? Sorry, folks. Be with you in just 1 second. What should I do?
If we don't think this is going to work from here, we could try to share it on this and just do slow.
I am open to... Let's try it one more time. We didn't have this problem before.
Yeah.
Let's see. Now we've got multiple Peters again.
So I'll just see which one
yep.
the slides show up for, and then the other one I'll eject. It's probably going to be this one. There we go. So I'll just remove.
Okay. All right. Sorry, folks. So like I said, we're going to be drawing on the academic literature and strategy, especially from the perspective of the Austrian school. So what is strategy anyway? What do I mean by strategy? The broadest definition, come on, slides. Okay, sorry. You know, the word strategy in any social context, right, refers to the actor's plans or goals or objectives. And we might think of an individual's strategy in isolation. You know, I want to quench my thirst. I actually have a little bit of a cold today, so I've got two drinks in front of me. I want to quench my thirst. I want my throat to feel better. I will take I'll take a drink of water. But that's really not all that interesting. It's more interesting, especially in a business context, to think about how we interact with other people, right? So I want, Danny, who's helping me here with this particular course, I want Danny to do something to help me achieve my objectives of teaching this course. I need him to do certain things on the technology side. He needs me to prepare the lectures and to show up on time and so forth. And for each of us to achieve our objectives, we need to somehow entice the other person to play along, right? We need to get the other person to cooperate with us so we can coordinate our behavior. Now, thinking of strategy in this very general context helps us to realize that strategy is not the same thing as economics. So strategic thinking often uses economic concepts, right? But there are a lot of other contexts in which we might think of strategy apart from economics per se. Right, so I'm using Mises' notion of economics as human action in what Mises calls a catalactic context. Right, so where we have private property, where we have exchange, money, and prices, and so forth. Strategy is also useful for thinking about warfare or the analysis of criminal behavior. Right, where exchange and pricing might play a role, but does not necessarily play one. So you might want to think of strategy as part of praxeology, Mises' term for the general analysis of human action. Well, it's not necessarily part of economics in the narrower sense. Okay, we've lost our slides again.
Okay. Let's just
what
switch.
Can we...
let's just switch to the slides
okay.
on this.
So how do we do that?
Here, I'll do it.
Oops. Uh-oh. Okay.
So we just need to... load the slides. Downloads.
Oh, perfect.
Oh, but it's PDF, so it won't. Well, I could do a slideshow of the PDF, but if you want to email me the PowerPoint, that it'll probably work better.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, hold on, folks. Sorry. Bear with us for just a second.
So what we're going to do is we're just going to have the slides load from the camera computer. So it might be mostly slide-oriented and not video-oriented, because when it's loading from the same account, you can't toggle back and forth. So sorry about that, guys. For some reason, we're having trouble with our Wi-Fi, it looks like. But the computer that we're loading it onto now is has a hardwired connection, so that won't be a problem. Okay, so you emailed it?
Yes.
Okay.
And of course, because of the Wi-Fi,
right? Then it's slow.
You know, you could just show the PDF.
The PDF.
If you want.
Okay.
Why not?
Yeah, because I think there's a slideshow mode.
Mm-hmm. Under view, yeah. Slideshow, yeah. Next to last one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so then. Come on, you gotta see the... Okay, maybe we'll need to do full screen. Okay, rethink that, How about this way? Screen share.
Okay, you should have it in PDF now.
Oh, okay.
I mean, sorry, PowerPoint.
PowerPoint, okay. It's weird. I'm clicking on it and it's not responding.
But no, I'm not in.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So sorry, we're having bandwidth problems and problems with the application. Not sure exactly what's going wrong, but we'll need to do video only for now. So Peter, did you want to tell them what slide you're on?
Yeah, sure.
So you can download the slides from Moodle and open them up on your own computer, and then Peter will tell you what slide when he's switching to the next slide. But for the Google Hangout part, it'll have to be all video. So sorry about that.
Okay, yeah. So if you have a copy of the slides, they're posted on Moodle in PDF form. I'm on the second slide, slide number two, which just says what is strategy, and I'll try to talk you through the slides. Hopefully, some of you will have access to the slides in front of you. I'll give you just a second to get those up. Let's see, can we get that chat window back? Let's see. It's this one.
Here.
Yeah. Okay, really sorry about that, folks. We're not sure exactly what the problem is, but we cannot get the Hangout to connect to the machine that has the slides on them. So you'll just have to look at my pretty face and assume that everything I'm telling you is exactly right. No. If you look at the slide that says what is strategy, I'm pointing out that in a general sense, strategy is about interactions with other people, right? A lot of the research on strategy, as some of you know, was developed during the Cold War, right, as part of the analysis of military conflict. And I'm sure many of you have studied the famous Prisoner's Dilemma game, which is often used to analyze nuclear strategy. And in fact, a lot of the game theory that went into that kind of analysis was developed at the RAND Corporation in the 1950s and 1960s, as depicted in, you know, things like the movie Dr. Strangelove. Now, the reason we're interested in it here is because in the last 20, 30 years, there's been an explosion of interest in applying these kind of strategic concepts to look at business problems, right? So business strategy in the most general sense refers to policies adopted by managers to try to make the firm perform well, right? To increase firm performance, to get more profit, to get some kind of competitive advantage. If you read the academic literature on strategy, you often hear the term sustained competitive advantage, that strategy is about firms' attempts, managers' attempts to achieve sustained competitive advantage. What that means, right, is some kind of performance that's better than the performance of rival firms. And it's not something just sort of ephemeral or the result of chance, right? Any firm might have a good quarter or even a good year just, you know, without managers being particularly skilled at doing their jobs. But sustained competitive advantage is some notion of repeated or ongoing performance advantages relative to rivals. Two remarks on that. Right, from an Austrian perspective, the firm's objective is not what you might call supranormal profits. So those of you who have studied mainstream neoclassical economics, right, know that in the competitive general equilibrium model of mainstream economics, firms earn zero profits in equilibrium. Right, so any positive economic profit is a result of market power or monopoly effects. Right, and so some approaches to strategy that build on neoclassical economics say, well, the objective of the firm is to earn, you know, profits above the normal rate, where the normal rate of profit is zero. We're not talking about that, right? Because in the Austrian understanding of markets, there's no such thing as normal profit, right? There's the real world is never in this kind of competitive general equilibrium state where the normal thing is to earn zero. And anything above zero must be either the result of luck or the result of entry barriers or monopoly privilege or the exercise of so-called market power. I'll talk later in the lecture, if we have time, about the concept of rent. Monopoly profit in the neoclassical model is sometimes described as Marshallian rents, named after Alfred Marshall. Other thing to note is that you know, the very notion of sustained competitive advantage is a little bit misleading in a dynamic, rapidly changing economy, right? In any economy, right? All competitive advantage may be temporary or transitory, Because we have innovation, we have entrepreneurship, we have uncertainty, and no firm can ever be sure that its, you know, strong market position today is going to last, right? You say, oh, but what about Apple? Well, I mean, Apple actually had a bad quarter this last quarter, as some of you know. Apple's still doing pretty well. It's hardly on the verge of bankruptcy. But there's no guarantee that the market leaders of today, Google, Apple, Amazon, or Caterpillar, or BMW, or whatever, in any market, that these will be the market leaders of tomorrow, right? Because we understand that we live in a dynamic world. So all advantage may, in fact, be ultimately temporary. And there's even some academic literature. If you can look, find articles like The Age of Temporary Advantage, urging managers to focus on innovation, right? And always trying to make things better and do things better, not to sort of rest on one's laurels. Now, I mentioned interaction before, right? So the way to achieve profits or competitive advantage, right? It always depends on the way a firm interacts with not only its rivals, but also its customers, its suppliers, you know, maybe regulators or other market participants as well. A lot of the strategy literature, a lot of the analysis of strategy uses game theory. We're going to talk a little bit about game theory later on, but I want to state up front that game theory, in my view, is not in any sense necessary for the analysis of business strategy. It may be useful as a way of illustrating certain concepts, but we don't want to take game theory too seriously, so don't get hung up on that. Okay, I'm turning to the next slide here. If you're following along at home, this slide has a pink T-shirt with Bohm Bawerk's picture on it. Don't ask me why the T-shirt is pink. I was just looking for a nice illustration of the Austrian concept of value, and a Google image search brought up a pink T-shirt with Bohm Bawerk's picture on it, so how could I resist using that? It actually has a nice quote on it, if you can read it. Bohm Bawerk is saying, "Value does not come out of the workshop, but out of the wants which goods satisfy." That's a great Austrian quotation. This slide is titled Value Creation and Value Capture. Essential to firm profitability is the notion that somebody somewhere is creating some economic value for consumers, right? Remember, in the Austrian concept of value, value is subjective. Value ultimately comes from the ability of a good or service to satisfy some consumer want. And then that value is imputed up the supply chain, right? So valuations that are expressed by consumers in purchasing decisions, right, and can be and result in revenues measured in money, right? Those revenues can then be imputed to other participants in the value chain using the principle of marginal productivity that we discussed before. Right? So what does that mean in practical terms? What are some ways in which value is created by entrepreneurs, by firms? Right? Well, it could be by creating new products and services, by creating new markets or facilitating new transactions. Right? So companies like eBay, PayPal, maybe even Bitcoin, right, that facilitate transactions that otherwise would have been not at all possible or at least more difficult. Reducing production costs or transaction costs of producers, right? So making the same thing but making it better or making it more cheaply is a way of creating economic value. Reducing the transaction costs or shopping costs for the consumer can be another way of facilitating new transactions, and again, making things, creating value for consumers. So again, when I use the word value in most of our conversation today, right, most of, in context, we're typically talking about value that is realized in a commercial context, right? So we're not talking just about the subjective valuations that are in consumers' heads. We're talking about valuation that is expressed in money, right, as consumers are willing to pay for things in the market. Now, lesson number one in business strategy is that creating economic value to the consumer does not guarantee that you, as a producer, will actually capture any of that value. Right? So, I could, here I've got this styrofoam cup in front of me. I could invent some radical new technology, a better cup, a stronger cup, a lighter cup, a cup that insulates better against temperature. If I produce that cup, I might be able to earn some economic profit, at least in the beginning. But if it's very easy for my rivals to replicate my actions, right? If I publish the recipe, if I put my technical specifications, on my website, or if it's very easy for somebody else to reverse engineer the cup, to copy the cup, then the market maybe becomes flooded with identical cups, and consumers have no reason to prefer mine over somebody else's, and maybe I don't actually make any money from that, right? Or lots of entrepreneurs can make a little bit of money from selling this radical new design. Now, maybe I'm the one who came up with it, right? So it's my intellect, my creativity, my willingness to bear uncertainty in trying this thing out that created economic value to consumers. But that doesn't mean the money's in my pocket, right? My rivals may be able to compete those profits away. So what I'm interested in, if I want to make money, right, is how I can capture economic value that I've created or that other people have created. So how do you capture value? How do you capture economic value? How do you do something that other firms cannot also do? Well, there's a couple of different ways to think about this, right? It's quite common in the strategy literature to distinguish between two different approaches to value capture, right? One approach focuses on monopoly privilege, right? So if I can go to the government and get an exclusive government license to produce this cup, you know, in the old imperial system, if I could get a little stamp that goes on here, you know, the official styrofoam cup of the queen or something like that, right? And nobody else can produce this cup upon pain of death. Well, then that's a pretty good barrier to competition, right? That's good for my business. But it doesn't have to be a legal barrier, right? Maybe I can keep the recipe secret, right? I can keep the formula secret. Or maybe I have some brand name reputation, right? Consumers don't really know when they buy a styrofoam cup if it's going to work or not. Now, if I have previously established a reputation for trustworthiness and I put my personal stamp, you know, Peter Klein stamp of approval, my brand on the cup, then maybe other firms who don't have that same reputation, other producers don't have that same brand name recognition, might not be able to duplicate what I'm doing. Second approach for capturing value is to make it where, you know, even without an entry barrier, nobody else can do what I do, right? Maybe there's, you know, these cups are lovingly assembled by a master craftsman, right? Say his name is, Bob Murphy. Bob Murphy is an expert styrofoam cup maker, and there's only one Bob Murphy and only one man who knows how to make these cups. And if I hire him, if I have an exclusive contract with Bob Murphy, then, you know, nobody else is going to be able to produce the same thing. So you might think of, producing wine or operating a restaurant, right? Take a celebrity chef, you know, Bobby Flay or Thomas Keller or somebody like that. You know, if you can only make a Thomas Keller dish with Thomas Keller being the one who assembles it, then whoever employs Thomas Keller in his restaurant is going to have a competitive advantage over other firms that cannot employ the services of Thomas Keller. Okay? So remember that there must be some, the entrepreneur needs some way to capture that value. Otherwise, simply creating it is not going to be enough. Okay, next slide. Look at the slide that's titled Strategy Formulation, How to Capture Value. Here's where I have a little bit more detail on these two approaches that I just mentioned. They go under different names. The sort of, you know, market power or monopoly or entry barrier approach is sometimes called the external approach, whereas the sort of unique factors of production approach is sometimes called internal. And these aren't perfect labels, but, you know, they actually might be helpful to us, right? So I have on my slide just sort of a laundry list of, you know, some ways that you might distinguish between these two. The external approach focuses on the business environment, who your competitors are, how you relate to suppliers and customers and so forth, the internal approach tends to focus on the firm's unique resources and capabilities. In the external approach, the primary unit of analysis is usually the industry, right? Some of you may have read the books by the famous author Michael Porter. Michael Porter has developed a particular way of doing industry analysis, what's called the five forces approach. And the five forces approach, which I'll discuss in more detail in a second, is usually applied at the industry level. You know, the goal is the coffee cup industry a good industry to be in, or is that a bad industry to be in? The internal approach looks more at the level of the firm rather than the industry, right? So in this external approach, we're looking at so-called market power in the neoclassical sense of that term. How many firms are in the market? How easy is it for other firms to get into the market? You know, do you have legal protection? Do you have other kinds of entry barriers and so forth? The internal approach uses other kinds of analytical tools, in particular, the so-called VRIO or VRIN approach that I mentioned last week that's associated with what's called the resource-based theory of the firm. You know, which of these approaches is correct? Well, I mean, each approach has some strengths and weaknesses, right? The external approach, you know, maybe tends to downplay differences among firms within an industry, right? Like you might say, oh, this is a great time to be in the automobile industry, but a horrible time to be in the airline industry. Okay, fine, but if I'm in the automobile industry, I might be more interested in heterogeneity among firms within that industry rather than simply choosing what industry to be in or not. If I'm already in that industry and it's difficult to get out, the exit costs are high, then just knowing that, you know, being in the automobile industry would be better, it may not be particularly helpful to me. At the same time, the internal approach, you know, maybe focuses too much on firm-specific characteristics. Maybe all airline producers are more or less the same, and there isn't a whole lot that one airline firm can do to distinguish itself from other airline firms. You know, that's probably not strictly true. And if you look at airlines, certainly in the U.S. case, you know, Southwest and JetBlue have a different kind of model than the legacy carriers. But nonetheless, maybe the internal approach focuses too heavily on unique firm resources without thinking enough about the business environment. Okay, next slide. Sorry, I realize I don't have numbers on my slide, but this is the slide that's titled The External Approach, Gaining and Sustaining Monopoly Power. This is the approach associated with Michael Porter. So Porter's idea, Porter's model, if you like, is that profitability or competitive advantage is ultimately, the proximate determinant of profitability or competitive advantage is the degree of rivalry in an industry. Right? So you want to be in an industry where the degree of rivalry is low. You know, where you have just a few firms that don't compete against each other too aggressively. They tend to copy each other's behavior. Maybe it's easy to cartelize this industry, you know, de jure or de facto. That's the kind of industry you want to be in. Now, Michael Porter, working out of a neoclassical economics framework, tends to measure the degree of rivalry with some kind of industry concentration measure. And some of you are familiar with these metrics, the four-firm concentration ratio, or the six-firm concentration ratio, or some kind of Herfindahl index. You can Google these if you want to figure out, if you want to see how they're calculated. But they're ways to try to capture the intensity of rivalry within an industry. They're pretty weak proxies, right? Because they really, number one, they just look at a snapshot view of an industry, and they basically count the number of firms, or they try to, you know, weigh the relative market shares of the top firms. From an Austrian perspective, this is a pretty pretty bad way to capture rivalry. But then Porter says there are four sort of ultimate factors that determine the degree of rivalry, the proximate factor, right? And these are the threat of entry from new firms, the threat of substitutes and complements produced by existing firms, the bargaining power of suppliers, and the bargaining power of buyers. right? So if you had an industry, take airlines, for example, where the threat of entry is low, if it's easy for other firms to get into the commercial aviation industry, and, you know, if you think about airlines, if you think of the industry not being airlines, right, but a particular route or city pair, the entry costs are actually fairly low. I mean, the main barrier to entry is being able to secure airline landing slots, and those are controlled in most cases by government agencies. So that's a significant barrier to entry. But if you have access to a landing slot, you know, getting a plane there is not that difficult. I mean, that's the nature of planes. They're highly mobile assets. So, you know, another airline could just easily fly its planes into your market, your city pair, and compete with you. So the threat of entry in an airline city pair, air traffic city pairs, is fairly high. Threat of substitutes and complements. Are there other products that people could consume instead? If the city pair is Los Angeles to Chicago, there's not a whole lot of competition from rental cars or buses or high-speed trains. If the city pair is London to Paris, then you have competition from trains, maybe competition from driving. And, you know, again, if we're talking about, business trips that are purchased by business people collaborating to build products or whatever, then maybe Skype is a competitor, right? Maybe Google Hangouts, well, not Google Hangouts because they've failed us today, but, you know, any kind of video conferencing technology, maybe that's a competitor too. Right, so what counts as a potential substitute depends on the technology in that particular market. Right, and then you get bargaining power of suppliers, bargaining power of buyers. Right, in Porter's idea, Porter's model, you know, you want to be in an industry where you're sort of big and strong, and there are lots of small suppliers who are weak and who are not able to organize themselves or bargain with you effectively. I mean, that's another reason why, from a Five Forces point of view, the airline industry is probably not such a great industry to be in, because, you know, you have for large airplane bodies, you have basically two firms, Boeing and Airbus. They have a lot of bargaining power. They can, it's hard for you to negotiate on price with Boeing and Airbus. Buyer power is actually pretty strong in retail air transportation, right? Because now you got, it's not like the old days where you had to buy from the airline or go to a travel agent. Now you've got Expedia and Orbitz and Kayak and any number of search engines where it's very easy for customers to shop based on price. So one could easily imagine a Porter-style analysis of the airline industry, which would say, you know, this is really not the best industry to be in. And if you're in it, maybe you want to look for ways to increase your monopoly, you know, privilege by getting government grants or negotiating with the airports to keep your rivals out, trying to, get planes from one of those regional jet manufacturers instead of Boeing and Airbus and so forth. If you look in Harvard Business Review or the Harvard Business School case website, or just do some Google searches for, you know, a Five Forces analysis of Industry X or Industry Y, you can find hundreds of these. And you may or may not find them useful. Again, this doesn't sound very congenial from an Austrian point of view, does it? And I think a lot of strategists have said, you know, gee, instead of looking at those kind of things, let's look more at internal resources and capabilities. That seems more likely to be a source of competitive advantage. So look at the next slide that is headlined, The Internal Approach: Developing or Acquiring Superior Factors of Production. I mentioned this briefly last week, the kind of attributes of resources that one would want to analyze would be the value of the resource. Is this resource valuable? If not, I don't want it. If it is, well, then I next want to ask, is it rare? Right? If it's valuable but everybody has one, then me having it is not going to give me sustained competitive advantage. Okay, if it's valuable and it's rare, how easy is it for other people to imitate or copy this resource? If they can easily copy, then maybe I don't want it, and so forth. So I want resources that are not only valuable, but also rare, costly to imitate, and my firm is organized in some way that I can take advantage of this resource. Now, of course, it won't surprise you that in doing this kind of analysis, we find that the most valuable resources tend to be intangible resources. I mean, or I should say, certainly they can be intangible in this framework, right? And, you know, probably, the machine that makes the Styrofoam cup is unlikely to be all that unique a machine. And all due respect to my good friend Bob Murphy, he's probably not, it's not likely there's going to be a master cup maker, like a master brewer, master winemaker. What's more likely to be a unique resource or a resource that's valuable, rare, difficult to imitate, and I'm organized to take advantage of, is some kind of knowledge, right? Some proprietary business method that I have, my secret formula for making Coca-Cola or making Styrofoam cups, my so-called intellectual property. I'm not going to get into any of the debates in this class that many of you like to have about whether intellectual property is a coherent concept, whether it should be legally protected. That's a subject for another day, and actually I covered it in my a previous course I did on for Mises Academy on networks and the new economy, I think we called it. And you can find that as an archived course. You can do a home study on it, or you can argue about it on Facebook with your closest friends. The point is, however a firm is able to protect proprietary knowledge, even just through trade secrets and non-disclosure agreements and so forth, that is likely to be a good source of competitive advantage. Things like customer loyalty and reputation, those are also difficult to imitate, right? I mean, if you look at eBay or Amazon, I mean, there's no sort of legal barrier to me setting up my own auction website or my own payment processing site like PayPal, or for me to create my own cryptocurrency, Klein Coin, that could be the next cryptocurrency. Is anybody going to use those things? Will people be willing to enter their credit card information into the Klein.com, auction site? Will they be willing to link the Klein Pal, to their account at Bank of America or something? Will they be willing to use Klein Coin for transactions? Probably not, because I'm a nobody, I'm not trustworthy, they don't know that I'm going to take care of their money and so on. So companies like eBay and PayPal and, I guess Bitcoin, if you want to call it a company in this context, they have reputational advantages that are difficult to imitate. So that can be a source of sustained competitive advantage as well. Okay, quick note, who gets the returns to these superior factors of production? One thing that I've noticed as I look at this literature is that sometimes people are sloppy about this, right? They assume that, well, if the firm can acquire superior factors of production, then the entrepreneur will make a blank load of money. You see this expressed, in sort of trite sayings, and the motivational posters that the website despair.com makes fun of. You see things like, well, the secret to our success is we hire the best people. It's not at all obvious that having the best people is going to make the firm any money, right? Why? Well, think about it from the point of view of factor markets that we talked about last week and in the first week of the semester, from an Austrian imputation theory point of view, right? If I, let's go back to the Bob Murphy example. Suppose that Bob Murphy really is, a unique, valuable resource. He's the only guy who knows how to make these cups that I can sell at a premium. Well, if there's only one Bob Murphy, right, and if I can't employ Bob Murphy, my next best alternative is to employ Joe Salerno, and, he's an Italian guy from New Jersey. There's no way he could make effective Styrofoam cups. Then, Bob Murphy is in a pretty good bargaining position relative to me, right? I mean, yes, if I have Bob, I can make these great cups, and I can sell them at a much higher price than if I had cups that were made by Joe Salerno. But if Bob Murphy knows this, right, he can negotiate for a higher wage than otherwise. In other words, Bob can negotiate, right, for a wage that's much higher than the wage that I would pay Joe Salerno. Because Bob knows that his discounted marginal revenue product is very high relative to the discounted marginal revenue product of Joe Salerno, right? So, you know, Bob Murphy is going to capture a lot of the, you know, a lot of those revenues that I get from selling these cups in terms of his own salary, right? This brings up the notion of a Ricardian rent, right? So the article by Matthews that I asked you guys to read talks about Ricardian rents. Ricardo's notion of a rent is, a rent is sort of a differential payment to a superior factor of production, right? So the difference between the wage that Bob Murphy can earn in making these cups and the wage that Joe Salerno could earn in making those cups, right? That margin between Bob Murphy's wage and Joe Salerno's wage is an extra rent that goes to Bob Murphy, right? So in Ricardo's terminology, Bob Murphy gets the, you know, the wage equal to the DMRP of a generic cup maker plus a little extra, the extra that goes, that you know, comes from the fact that Bob is a better cup maker than, you know, than Joe Salerno. So if, you know, you think about this with, you know, star athletes or entertainers, you know, LeBron James, a lot of his salary is a Ricardian rent in the sense that, you know, he's getting paid more than, you know, if you didn't have LeBron, you'd have somebody else, Kevin Durant or something. Actually, Kevin Durant has been on a scoring tear lately. But, you know, take the next best basketball player who's not quite as good as LeBron James, right? The difference between what that guy would be worth to the Miami Heat and what LeBron James is worth to the Miami Heat, that little wedge, right, that's a Ricardian rent that goes to LeBron James. Okay, so if I have a factor of production that is generating me all of this extra value and there's only one of it, right, then a lot of that return, the return to that superior factor of production, goes to the factor owner, not necessarily the entrepreneur that employs that factor. Okay? I mean, think about it, right? If Bob Murphy is the greatest cup maker in the universe, okay, but he's the only one, and he can negotiate a high wage for me, then I may actually make less money selling super-duper high-quality cups if I have to pay Bob Murphy a high salary to make them than I would get if I sold crappy cups that are made by Joe Salerno, right? You may actually make more money by hiring crappy workers rather than superior workers. It all depends on how much you have to pay those workers. Right, to make money, I want the biggest gap between the revenues I receive and the factor payments I have to make. And maybe I can widen that gap by hiring lower quality factors, right? If I can get them on the cheap, all right? Now, I should say that what if, you know, Bob Murphy, you know, he's good at making cups, but only when he's paired up with Mark Thornton. You know, so Bob, you know, he shapes it, and then Mark Thornton, you know, I don't know, puts the lid on the cup or something, right? And they work together as a team. And Bob's labor is more valuable when combined with Mark Thornton's labor than when combined with somebody else's labor. If I already have Mark Thornton in my firm, right, then, you know, the value of Bob combined with Mark is higher than the value of Bob if he works for another firm and combines his labor for someone else, right? So Bob can only negotiate with me. He can only hold out or threaten to walk away from the wage that's equal to what he would earn in his next best opportunity. If there's something unique about me in combination with Bob, my firm in combination with Bob, then he cannot negotiate for all of that Ricardian rent. Okay, some of it will go back to me. In other words, I will benefit from the, you know, unique combination of factors that I employ. Okay, so the way for you as a firm to make money is either, you know, hire factors of production that you can get on the cheap, or find some way to combine factors in a way that nobody else is doing, so that then you don't have to pay your factors the full value of what they're contributing to production, right? You get to keep the amount that goes to you for assembling that unique combination. Now, all of that is in addition to the money that I get from entrepreneurial profit, right? Remember this whole deal about, you know, paying factors equal to their discounted marginal revenue product. Well, the discounted marginal revenue product, or the actual marginal revenue product, is only realized later, after I've brought my goods to market and sold them, right? Ex ante, when I pay the factor, I don't really know. I mean, I have to pay, I negotiate with Bob, but I don't actually know until later how much the cups are going to sell for, right? So the difference between what I paid Bob and what his discount, what his discounted marginal revenue product turns out to be later, is either entrepreneurial profit or entrepreneurial loss. Okay, so that's what the Matthews article is trying to get at. Matthews is criticizing the existing strategy literature for saying you guys are focused on these Ricardian rents, but you're forgetting that the greatest source of money in my pocket as an entrepreneur is entrepreneurial profit, which comes from the successful bearing of Knightian uncertainty, as we talked about last week. Okay, and again, just a terminological note, because the word rent is used in so many different and potentially confusing ways. I mentioned Marshallian rent a few slides back, right? That's a word that some people use to monopoly profit in the neoclassical sense of profit that you earn from having a downward sloping demand curve, which I think most of us would agree is a pretty silly and, you know, is not a very useful concept. Ricardian rent is, again, this notion of the extra payment that you get from being better, the factors get from being superior than the next best alternative factors. Rothbard uses the term rent in yet a third sense, and I'm only mentioning this because some of you have taken my microeconomics course where we talked a lot about rents in Rothbard sense, so I just don't want to confuse you. It's the same four-letter word, rent, but it has an entirely different meaning in Marshall's and Ricardo's senses from Rothbard's. Rothbard is following the American economist Frank Fetter. So what we might call a Fetter rent is simply a payment per period of time for the use of a factor service. And by the way, that's the common sense notion, right? When you rent a car, you pay so many dollars per day or per week for the services of that car. When you rent an apartment, you pay so many dollars per month or whatever. The common sense notion of rent is the payment to borrow a productive resource or consumption good, right, per period of time. That's not what Marshall meant by rent, and it's not what Ricardo meant by rent. If you have read the public choice literature, people talk about rent-seeking, the rent-seeking approach to politics, or when people in strategy talk about firms trying to achieve these rents, they're either talking about Marshallian or Ricardian rents. It's too bad that the same term has been used in so many confusing ways. Okay, final note is that the owner of a superior factor of production does not necessarily have to start a firm to use that factor, right? I mean, as we've already seen, you can hire the factor out, right? So Bob Murphy does not have to become a cup entrepreneur to benefit from his superior cup-making abilities. I mean, he could if he wants to bear Knightian uncertainty, but he might prefer to let somebody else, Klein, bear that uncertainty. He might prefer to hire himself out to Klein in exchange for a fixed wage and let Klein bear the uncertainty. I mention that because, you know, a lot of people mistakenly believe, oh gosh, you know, if I discover oil on my land, well then I have to go into the oil refining business to profit from my ownership of the rights to this oil field. And of course that's not true, right? Because you can simply contract with an expert in oil refining and let them set up shop on your land, right? You can obviously sell your land, but you could also lease your land. And you know, I mean, as most of you know, the vast majority of patents in the U.S. are actually not used in production for two reasons, right? I mean, some of them are just being held in reserve by patent trolls or, you know, as part of, firms are threatening to sue somebody and they have this portfolio of patents so they can prevent other people from doing things. But even of the patents that are actually in use to produce goods and services, more than 50% are licensed, meaning the firm that is producing the patented thing is not the owner of the patent. The patent owner is another firm, or, you know, a lone inventor who is just writes a contract with the patent user to pay a royalty stream in exchange for using the patent. Anyway, the point is, the fact that you own unique factors of production does not mean that you have to go into production to benefit from those factors. Maybe it's best for you to let somebody else who has the expertise in production or who is skilled at entrepreneurship, skilled at uncertainty bearing, you know, let them do the work. Okay, let me pause for just a minute and get a refreshing beverage here. Okay, now look at the slide that's titled Strategic Interaction. Right, by strategic interaction, I mean something more specific than the general notion of strategy that we've already been talking about. And just to let you guys know, I'm going a little bit, we're a little bit behind schedule because we had some technical difficulties, and unless Danny tells me otherwise, I'm actually just going to stretch it out a little bit, or we may stretch it out a little bit beyond 6 o'clock today Eastern. I'm sorry, 7 o'clock Eastern. So I'm going to go a little bit longer before stopping for questions than I usually do. So when a lot of people think of strategy, they think of the prisoner's dilemma, they think of Nash equilibrium, they think of drawing these complicated game theoretic diagrams. So there is a literature on business strategy that uses a lot of game theory and draws a lot of diagrams like the little ones you can see here on the slide. You know, I have a, what would you call it? I'm kind of a middle ground view on game theory. There's some Austrian economists who would say, you know, game theory is all completely illegitimate and should never be used because it, you know, it's using mathematics. It looks like sometimes it seems to embrace cardinal utility, and you know, we should just sort of throw it out. There are other Austrian economists who say, oh, yeah, game theory is great. We should use all game, you know, game theory is not only is it great, it's actually Austrian, because one of the co-inventors of game theory was Oskar Morgenstern, who was a pupil of Ludwig von Mises at Vienna. Famous book by by Oskar Morgenstern along with John von Neumann. I think it's called Economic Theory of Games, right, in the 1949, I believe, somewhere in the 1940s. That's sort of the founding text of game theory. I've heard some people say, well, Morgenstern was Mises' student, so therefore game theory is the fullest expression of Misesian praxeology. I don't think that view is correct either. You know, as in all things, I'm a moderate, right? I'm not one of these crazy extremists like you find at places like the Mises Institute, right? I think that game theory can be useful as a teaching tool. Sometimes it may be helpful to illustrate some aspects of strategic interaction using diagrams or maybe even using equations. Again, not as a means of deriving new theory, but just as a way of sort of explicating some relationships or illustrating some relationships, you know, kind of for classroom use. I think it's fine. We should not take it too seriously. There are some cases where the use of formal game theoretic tools actually is misleading and adds, and is confusing and incorrect. Just, you know, for example, if you look at the next slide, I've got a larger version. You've probably seen, some of you have seen these diagrams, like the one in the top left of the slide that has, you know, four boxes, player A along the top, choosing between columns, player B on the side, choosing between rows, and, you know, they can choose to cooperate or defect. This is a prisoner's dilemma kind of game. And you get these payouts in the boxes. And, you know, you get numbers. You see numbers in the boxes. And sometimes when these illustrations are used, you know, in a classroom, they're almost described as utility numbers or even called utils. You know, if player A chooses, chooses the right column and player B chooses the top row, they end up in the top right cell and player A gets one util, you know, and player B gets four utils or something like that. Okay, you know, that's not right. Now, there are some games where the numbers you choose are kind of arbitrary as long as they're ordered in a certain way, right? In fact, you can, with a prisoner's dilemma game, you don't need specific numbers to make it work. You just need certain payoffs to be greater than certain other payoffs but less than certain other payoffs. You can do it in ordinal terms. But once you start, repeating the game or adding a discount factor to the game, trying to add up the benefits of one set of strategies over another over time, then you start to get into problems with cardinal utility, and I think there you get into trouble, right? But simply drawing a 2x2 matrix and thinking about who might want to move left or right or up or down, or one of these tree diagrams like you see for so-called sequential move games, I don't think that's illegitimate per se. I mean, we just have to judge each one of these on a case-by-case basis. Is it useful? Is it informative? Does it aid our understanding? If so, then drawing a diagram is fine. If it's misleading or confusing, then we shouldn't draw the diagram. So what are some of the basic concepts associated with, you know, what I'll call sort of a game theoretic way of thinking about strategy? Thinking about it this way helps us to keep in mind, you know, the interdependence of joint actions and outcomes. Right, again, the point is, you know, if we think of the interaction between myself and Danny in terms of some kind of a game, you know, I have certain objectives. I want the Mises Academy course to go off well, and I want myself to look good on camera, and, you know, and I want the final exam handled a certain way. You know, my ability to get those outcomes, I don't have total control over those outcomes, right? Whether a particular lecture is delivered well or badly, or I should say is received well or badly by you guys, depends not only on how I'm speaking and how well I've prepared and how compelling are my examples, but also how well the technology works, the quality of the internet connection at the Institute, which just seems to be letting us down today, you know, a whole host of things that are outside my control. In other words, my well-being depends not only on choices that I make, but also on choices that Danny makes, and maybe choices that you guys make, and choices that our local ISP makes, and so forth. Right? So, I mean, all social interaction, right, unless we're talking about Robin Crusoe on his island, right, all social interaction involves some degree of interdependence in this sense. We want to think about the characteristics of the various participants in the activity or the players in the game, right? I mean, what do I want? What are my objectives? What does Danny want? What are his objectives? Right? I mean, you might say, again, in a sort of generic case, you know, professor wants, you know, the best quality lecture, you know, that the students will love. Maybe the technical support person wants, you know, they want the course to go off well, but they want it to be easy for them, right? So the tech support person, other things equal, will prefer a technology that doesn't require a lot of extra work on their part over a technology that requires a lot of extra work on their part. Of course, I'm not talking about Danny because he does everything, you know, as best as it can be done. But I'm talking a hypothetical here. So I need to know what his objectives are. Now, how do I know? Well, I don't. I can make an educated guess. So I have to try to figure out, well, what does Danny want and what does Danny know? What does Danny know about what I want and what I know? Right? What do I know about what I think he knows, about what I know, about what he thinks, what I think he knows, and so on and so forth. You know, sequence and timing are important. You know, do I make my choices without knowing what the other person's choices are, and then ex post it's revealed and we sort of settle up? Or does one of us get to move first and the other one move second? Do I get to wait and see what Danny does and then choose, you know, what I want to do? Or do we sort of have to both make a stab in the dark without knowing what the other person is doing? Those things can matter in trying to understand what happens and how satisfied each of us is with what happens. Now, in, you know, formal game theory, whether using math or these diagrams, you know, there's typically some notion of what is called an equilibrium, right? So, you know, what combination of actions on the part of the different players, you know, make some sense in terms of a plausible outcome? You know, we could have any possible, you know, set of outcomes, or in one of these 2x2s, right? If you have two players, each of whom has two potential moves. There are four possible outcomes, right? Player one chooses to A cooperates and B cooperates in the prisoner's dilemma. A cooperates, B defects, and so forth. We want to have some way of sort of evaluating, in this case, these four possible outcomes. Which ones, you know, make sense according to some criteria? And it turns out there are lots of different ways to try to make sense of outcomes, lots of different ways to try to define an equilibrium for one or more of these outcomes. The most common of these equilibrium constructs is the one that was invented by and popularized by John Nash, so-called Nash equilibrium. You know, you can read about Nash equilibrium. There's lots of things written about it, lots of Wikipedia entries about it, I'm sure. I would not recommend watching the movie A Beautiful Mind to get an understanding of what Nash equilibrium is, because they completely mess it up in the bar scene in the movie A Beautiful Mind. And I don't want to shock anybody, but it turns out John Nash himself is not quite as beefy and hunky as Russell Crowe. So Nash's idea is that, well, we have an equilibrium situation if, you know, you were to sort of ask everybody playing the game and say, okay, now that we've reached a particular outcome, if you had to do it all over again, would you do anything different than what you did to get here? Right? So suppose, again, in the prisoner's dilemma, you know, both prisoners have chosen the strategy to defect rather than to cooperate. Then you say, okay, knowing that the other guy defected, are you glad that you defected, or would you rather have done something else? And if that player says, okay, now that I know what the other guy did, yeah, I wouldn't have done anything differently than what I did. I don't regret my choice. And then we ask the same question of any other players in the game. And if everybody says, well, given what the other folks did, I couldn't do any better than what I did to get here, if that's true of every player, then according to Nash, you know, we can define that as an equilibrium outcome, right? It's sort of stable in the sense that nobody has ex post regret. Nobody wishes they could go back and do it another way. But, you know, there are lots of other concepts of equilibrium, too, in game theoretic strategy. You know, there are a lot of refinements to Nash equilibrium, you know, adding extra conditions to the Nash equilibrium, particularly if we look at more complicated games, either that have, you know, some characteristics of players that we don't know about, right? Like maybe I don't really know, does Danny prefer this or prefer that? Or if it's a game between me and Bob Murphy, you know, I'm the boss and he's the worker. You know, is Bob a hard worker or is he lazy? Is he loyal and likely to do what I want without a lot of extrinsic incentives? Or is he a lazy bum who won't do anything unless, you know, I'm closely monitoring him or giving him, you know, cash bonuses or whatever? If I don't know Bob's characteristics, then I have to make some educated guess about whether he's likely to be hardworking or lazy, and I might need a more complicated kind of equilibrium construct to handle those sorts of situations. Also, when we sort of play games over and over and over again, we might also need more complicated kind of game theoretic equilibrium constructs. You know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through a bunch of them. You can easily sort of figure, you know, do these on your own. But to make this work, we need some way of evaluating different outcomes and say, yeah, that's a pretty reasonable one, but this other one isn't. Let me just go through a couple of examples. We'll look at two categories, generic categories of games, what are called competition games and what are called coordination games. And again, don't take these labels too literally. I mean, you can say, well, there's coordination in any kind of game. That's true, but what you know, the label competition game refers to games in which you're sort of trying to beat the other player. You're trying to outthink or outwork the other player. If you win, he loses. Maybe there's zero sum, right? Whereas what's called a coordination game is one in which, you know, the way to win is to match what the other person does. And we'll look at those just now. Now, I'm not going to do any math at all. I'm actually not going to do any diagrams. I'm just going to kind of talk you through these games intuitively. partly just because it takes some time to go through the diagrams, and also because, I mean, if you look at the prisoner's dilemma, that's the first example that we'll look at. So now I'm turning to the slide that has as its header prisoner's dilemma games. I mean, there must be 1,000 articles and 100 books written about the prisoner's dilemma, and you can probably find lots and lots of good overviews online. And I'm sure some of you have studied the prisoner's dilemma before. If it's brand new to you, then you know you might want to read some of those, you know, intro to the prisoner's dilemma sorts of things online. There are websites you can go and play a prisoner's dilemma in real time against an opponent, or you can play against the computer. There are lots of animated presentations and little movies about the prisoner's dilemma. You can watch a movie like War Games or Dr. Strangelove to learn about the prisoner's dilemma. I'll just walk you through the basic intuition. Then you could come back and you can come back and rewatch the video, I guess. So the basic structure, you know, the famous example is the two prisoners. You know, you see it on TV shows like Law and Order all the time, right? So the two prisoners are caught. There's two suspects who are caught, you know, committing a crime, you know, robbing a convenience store, let's say. The district attorney only has enough evidence to convict each of the suspects of a lesser crime, like breaking and entering. The DA would like to convict each of the two suspects for a more serious crime, like armed robbery. So let's say armed robbery carries a much longer prison sentence than breaking and entering. The DA would like to be able to put both of these guys in jail for a long time for armed robbery, but doesn't have enough evidence to convict them of this. The only way to convict one of the suspects of armed robbery is to convince the other suspect to testify against his partner, right? So it's this classic thing, you know, where you put the two suspects in different rooms, and the DA goes to each one privately and says, hey, if you will testify against your partner, if you'll turn state's evidence and become a witness for the prosecution, the judge will be lenient with you, and you'll get a lighter sentence than you would otherwise get, right? And then the DA, of course, goes to the other suspect and says this to the other suspect, and the two suspects, you know, are kept in separate cells where they can't communicate with each other. Each one has to make an independent decision about whether to turn state's evidence or not. And, you know, if you go through sort of, you can work through different mathematical representations, but, you know, the logic says that, well, gosh, you know, if I'm one of the suspects, you know, if my buddy keeps his mouth shut, then, you know, if I also keep my mouth shut, we'll both get convicted of breaking and entering, but that's not so bad. At least we won't get convicted of armed robbery. But if I think my partner is going to keep his mouth shut, then I should really turn state's evidence, because, you know, the best I can be convicted of is breaking and entering, and I'll get leniency from the judge. You know, my partner will get convicted of armed robbery, so I'm actually better off if I think my partner is going to keep his mouth shut by blabbing, right, by confessing or becoming a witness for the prosecution. At the same time, right, if I think that my partner is going to turn me in, is going to rat me out, well, then I'm actually better off ratting him out also, right? I don't want to be the sucker left holding the bag, keeping my mouth shut while he turns me in, and then he gets a more lenient sentence for being a witness for the prosecution. If I think he's going to rat me out, I'm better off ratting him out also. You know, that's sort of intuitive, but what's less intuitive is if I think he's going to be an honorable thief, right? If I think he's not going to rat me out, I'm actually better off ratting him out and getting the most lenient sentence I can for myself. And, you know, if it's a symmetric problem where the other guy, you know, sort of faces the same incentives, then it's in my interest to rat my partner out, and it's in my partner's interest to rat me out. So we both end up ratting each other out, and we both get, you know, the worst possible sentence of armed robbery. You know, that's like the worst outcome for the two prisoners, you know, the best outcome for the DA. And so the Nash equilibrium in the one-shot prisoner's dilemma game is that both parties will confess, will accept the DA's offer, testify against each other, and they both get locked away for a very long time. And, you know, it's supposed to be kind of counterintuitive, Because you think, well, gosh, wouldn't it be better if they had both kept their mouths shut and then they could have both gotten the lighter sentence? You know, but not being able to explicitly coordinate, each making his own independent decision, they end up turning state's evidence and they end up with the worst possible outcome. You know, lots and lots of applications of this kind of thinking to warfare, you know, this theory of mutually assured destruction during the Cold War. You know, think about an arms race, right? So if you have the Americans and the Soviets building up nuclear capacity, you know, maybe even just having, you know, just a small number of nuclear weapons might be enough to completely, you know, obliterate the other side. But you don't want to have fewer weapons than the other side has, right? So, you know, if you think he has more than you currently have, then you want to increase your stockpile. If he thinks you have more than he has, he wants to increase his stockpile, right? So if you think you're behind, you want to catch up. You don't want to have the so-called missile gap or the bomber gap that they talked about during the Cold War, right? But what's even worse is if you think you've achieved detente, you know, if you think you have just as many as the other side, then you also want to have more so you can have a tactical advantage over the other side. So each side has an incentive to keep escalating its weapons stockpile, even though there's no sort of tactical advantage to having the same amount of weapons if it's a large number than if you have the same amount of weapons and it's a smaller number, right? You're actually both worse off having, say, 100 missiles each than 1,000 missiles each, because there's no tactical advantage to having 1,000 over 100 if you both have the same number, right? But you know, and you have to spend all that money on the extra 900 missiles. So you say, but the Nash equilibrium is for both sides to just keep adding to their stockpiles and you end up with an arms race. Wouldn't it be better if, like the two prisoners agreeing to keep their mouths shut, if the U.S. and the Soviets could have agreed not to increase their stockpiles? Right, so one way to think about this is, and I see people, someone has already asked in the chat room, why can't they just agree beforehand not to confess, right? Why can't the two prisoners just say, you know, right before they leap out of the car and into the 7-Eleven, okay, you know, here's what we're going to do. You hold the guy down. I'll tie him up. We get the money out of the safe. Oh, and by the way, if we're caught and we end up like on one of those TV shows that we've both watched, you know, you get in a room and I get in a room. Don't take the deal. It's a trap. The DA is trying to get us to rat each other out. Don't rat, you know, I won't say anything, you don't say anything. And the other guy says, yeah, good idea, and they shake hands on it. Then they go rob the convenience store. They're caught. They end up in the separate rooms. Now what do they do? Right? I mean, the problem is now they're right back in the same situation that I described originally. You know, you still have the option to rat your partner out, even though you agreed beforehand not to. Right, so it's the same game. It's just now the choice is: do I stick to the agreement I previously made, or do I violate the agreement that I previously made? And if I think the other guy is going to stick to the agreement, I'm better off violating it. If I think the other guy is going to violate the agreement, I'm better off violating it. You end up with the exact same outcome, right? So again, same thing with the U.S. and the Soviets. Just, you know, meeting at the negotiating table, like the SALT talks of the 1970s, and agreeing to reduce your stockpiles, it doesn't make any difference if there's not some kind of enforcement, right? Because then after the meeting's over, each side has to decide, okay, am I going to stick to the treaty that I just signed, or am I going to violate the treaty that I just signed? If I think he's going to violate the treaty, I better violate it too. If I think he's going to stick to the treaty, well, I'm going to violate it so I can have an advantage over him, okay? Lots of you know, attempts to apply this kind of thinking to strategic interaction among firms, right? You know, Coke and Pepsi are competing against what price to charge for a six pack, and you know, they'd like to both charge a high price, right, and have some sort of a cartel. But you know, if Coke thinks that Pepsi is charging $3 for a six-pack, it's in Coke's interest to charge $2.75 and compete away some of those customers, right? But then if Pepsi thinks that Coke is charging $2.75, then Pepsi wants to charge $2.50. You know, they end up in a destructive price war So it's like the opposite of the arms race, where they're competing to lower the price instead of to increase the price. Gee, wouldn't it be great if they could form a cartel, if they could sign an agreement not to compete against each other? You know, well, regardless of what the antitrust regime is, you know, in the country that we're talking about, even if they sign an agreement, legally or illegally, then they can still cheat on it, right? They can still have secret price cuts, you know, volume discounts, hidden discounts to certain preferred suppliers, coupons, rebates. There are all kinds of ways that they can discount, even if they formally agreed with their rival, you know, not to discount. So a lot of people have said, well, the key to successful competition, you know, between Coke and Pepsi is to figure out how to collude, figure out how to achieve collusion. And there are all kinds of more complicated games where you're trying to deter someone from entering your industry, maybe by threatening to engage in a price war with him if he enters, and trying to convince him that you would, in fact, price very aggressively if your rival did enter without knowing if, in fact, that he will. When people first started studying these games, a lot of them thought, you know, well, ha, 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 Adam Smith, up yours, right? The prisoner's dilemma proves that unfettered individualism, right, people making their own decisions, just looking out for their own well-being, leads to all of these bad outcomes where we're all worse off than if we could somehow have our behavior coordinated for us. The so-called tragedy of the commons, associated with, you know, overfishing, lack of well-defined property rights, or, you know, overgrazing, or doing too much hunting, and then you run the hunting grounds to extinction. You know, each of us selfishly, individually, is trying to bag as many deer as possible, but when we all do that, we run out of deer. Right? If we could somehow agree to restrain ourselves from catching so many deer, then we would all have more deer forever and be better off. And, you know, this is why the market is bad and socialism is good, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you can actually kind of detect a little hint of that in some of the, you know, more poorly written game theory textbooks. Of course, that, you know, is completely the wrong way to look at it, right? I mean, even in the one-shot prisoner's dilemma game, where you have this Nash equilibrium, you know, where the players are sort of unhappy with or not very satisfied with the Nash equilibrium that obtains, I mean, you can still get coordination through private voluntary means, enforceable contracts and so forth. You don't need the government at all. But, I mean, but the main lesson is the one-shot prisoner's dilemma is not a very interesting game. Life is not generally about single-period interaction with rivals, right? I mean, usually we interact with our rivals repeatedly over time, right? So, if, you know, if this is Bonnie and Clyde, you know, they rob stores all the time. And, you know, if, yeah, we're running out of time. If, you know, if Bonnie rats out Clyde, then he knows that after they get out, Clyde is not going to be willing to work with her again, right? If you're part of a mafia family, right, everybody knows if you remember that famous line from Goodfellas where the Henry Hill character, when he's caught for the first time, the Robert De Niro character tells him, you know, you learned your two most important lessons, never rat on your friends and always keep your mouth shut. Right? If you're part of a mafia family and you turn state's evidence, yeah, you get a more lenient sentence from the judge today, but then as you're walking, you know, out of the front door of the prison, you know, you get whacked. Right? So that's a game where you have to think of not only the benefits and costs to my action right now in the present, but how does this affect my future benefits and costs? Right? So Coca-Cola may say, hey, you know, if I undercut Pepsi this time, I'll get a little more profit this quarter, a little more revenue this quarter, but then Pepsi will never trust me again if we meet in a dark room to sign one of these handshake agreements. Right, so it's the possibility of future interaction with your rival that might lead you to act in a way that's sort of not in your immediate short-term interest. Right, so in a repeated prisoner's dilemma type game, you may be able to sustain the cooperative outcome, the one in which both parties get the maximum possible joint payoff without any sort of state intervention, right, if reputation effects are powerful enough. And there's a lot of social science literature using this kind of analysis to explain social norms more generally, right? We have all kinds of informal but binding conventions, rules of conduct that are sort of enforced just by reputation, right? I mean, I don't know, you don't, certainly in business dealings, how you present yourself to a possible customer, the way you present your business card, what information you reveal, how well you treat that customer, right? You try to treat that customer well or that supplier well because you hope to interact with them in the future, right? I mean, McDonald's Corporation could serve us all tainted meat and save money on meat inspections, and they might earn more revenue today, but of course that's not going to be good for them in the long run, okay? Another, by the way, those of you who, if you joined us late, we had a little bit of a technical difficulty. We lost about 15 or 20 minutes, so I'm going to go a little bit over the regularly scheduled time today. Of course, if you have to leave the live version, you'll have everything archived, so hopefully that won't be a problem. But just give me another minute, another 5 minutes or so, and we'll take some questions. One of the broader issues in this repeated game notion, and even in just some simple two-period or three-period versions, is a concept of what's called credible commitment, right? So, if Pepsi is saying to Coke, look, if you undercut, if you try to charge a lower price than what we agreed upon, we will match that price cut, and that won't be good for you. You know, so should Coke believe that Pepsi would actually match the price cut? I mean, if Coke did sort of, you know, cheat on the agreement, would it be in Pepsi's interest to match that price cut? Well, if the two firms have the same cost structure, it might be. But what if Pepsi is actually, you know, has higher production costs for whatever reason, based on where they're located or they're less efficient? Then, you know, Pepsi's boast to match the price cut may be kind of idle boasting, right? Coke may not believe that Pepsi would actually go through with it. And so that's not going to be a very effective deterrent if Coke doesn't believe that Pepsi really would engage in this aggressive behavior to deter, right? So, or in another case, if you're, sort of saying to a potential entrant into your industry, hey, I'm tough and strong. If you try to come into my market, I'm going to, you know, pull some really aggressive pricing tactics and you won't survive. I mean, whether that strategy is effective or not depends on what the potential entrant believes about whether you mean it. Right? Are you really tough and strong, you know, very efficient and lean, you really could engage in that price war? Or is it so, would it be so costly to you to price aggressively, they don't believe you, and therefore it doesn't work? A great example, as in all in many cases, comes from the world of parenting. Some of you guys probably have kids like I do. I mean, a lot of parents, in a fit of anger, if you're not paying attention, you might say, you know, to your kid, dang it, if you do that again, no Xbox for a year. You know, and then as soon as those words come out of your mouth as a parent, you kind of regret it, right? Because even if you're really a mean parent, right? I mean, most parents love the Xbox and the PlayStation and the Wii. That's like, you know, that's like electronic babysitting, right? I don't want to have to entertain my kids all the time. Sometimes I want them to go off and play Xbox and leave me alone, right? But if I've taken away their Xbox for a year because of something they did, and then they do another bad thing, so now what do I do? Or if I've taken away the Xbox and I want the kid to leave me alone, I can't go say play Xbox. So here's the point. If your kid is shrewd and your kid can sort of think this through a little bit, and this works with older kids, right? If you say, don't do that anymore or I'll take away your Xbox for a year, if the kid thinks, well, there's no way Dad would take away my Xbox for a year, he would just be hurting himself, right? Even if I do this bad thing that Dad doesn't want me to do, there's no way he would actually follow through on that punishment, so I'm going to do it anyway, right? In game theoretic language, any sort of threat of retaliation can only work if the other side believes that that threat is credible. So threats or commitments to engage in some kind of retaliation have to be believable, right? The other side has to believe that it would be in your interest to follow through, right? And maybe it isn't. I mean, maybe the kid knows that when I think about it in the cold light of day, I'm going to realize that even though I want to punish you, even though I want you to believe that, you know, I mean what I say, you know, it's just too painful for me actually to take away your Xbox for a year. If a kid knows that, then the threat is not credible. So in warfare, right, if you haven't ever watched the movie Dr. Strangelove, you must definitely watch it, because the plot involves the Americans, a crazed American Air Force colonel launching unilaterally a nuclear strike against the Soviets, and the Americans cannot recall the bomber for various reasons. There's no way the Americans can stop it. And so the American president is trying to convince the Russian premier, you know, gee, we're really sorry that happened, but, you know, okay, even if we destroy Moscow, I mean, that's pretty bad. We're sorry. But do you really want to launch a counterstrike? Because then the whole planet will be destroyed. I mean, wouldn't you rather have a planet but one destroyed city than an entire destroyed planet? I mean, so even though you have threatened to retaliate against us, do you really want to? It's not in your interest to do so. It's not a credible threat. That's why in the movie, and this also plays a role in the 80s movie War Games, which is another great game theory movie, you know, that they have a computer that automatically retaliates. But if you have a computer that cannot be turned off and automatically launches a huge retaliatory strike if the other side launches even one missile, well, that's a more effective deterrent than one in which humans have to make that call. Okay, last example before we stop. Again, we're running over time, but I'm doing so only because we lost some time because of technical difficulties. Let me go through a quick example of a coordination game. So this is the next to the last slide, or actually, it's the very last slide called coordination games, and then I'll stop. Different type of game. So, okay, imagine two institutions, both of which are in the business of delivering online education. It could be for-profit, they could be non-profit. One is called the Mises Institute, and one is called the Krugman Institute. And yes, I designed the logo of the Krugman Institute myself, showing off my mad PowerPoint skills. So suppose there are two organizations, the Mises Institute and the Krugman Institute, both seeking to attract students, right? Both seeking to attract customers for their online education platforms. Also suppose that there are two competing technologies or platforms for delivering online education. One is Google Hangout, the one that we're using for this course, and the other is WebEx, the platform that we've used for some of our other Mises Academy courses. If you've taken other Mises Academy courses with me or with Murphy or Salerno or whatever, you've probably used WebEx. Right now I'm not having very warm feelings towards Google Hangout, but we'll just leave that aside. Okay, so suppose, just to make the example interesting, that, you know, students can either do Mises Academy or Krugman Institute courses. They can either do Mises Institute courses or Krugman Institute courses. They can't do them both at the same time. Maybe they meet on the same day or whatever. And suppose that students have to make some durable technology-specific investments in either WebEx or Google Hangouts, right? Either you have to learn how to use it, there's some training, and once you learn how to use WebEx, that doesn't help you to use Google Hangouts and vice versa. Maybe you have to buy some specific equipment, you know, you have to have a certain kind of computer or tablet to watch one or the other. In other words, once a student has made a commitment to the Google Hangouts platform, they can't take any courses that use WebEx and vice versa. Okay, so the idea is, the Mises Institute and the Krugman Institute are, you know, they're trying to attract students, and they have to decide whether to use Google Hangouts or WebEx, right? Let's suppose that the Mises Institute, you know, kind of has a preference for Google Hangouts, and the Krugman Institute has a preference for WebEx. But suppose that this is kind of a new industry, it's sort of just a sort of an emerging market. Neither institute really has a whole lot of students using its products. And both institutes want the market to grow, right? And it's easier for the market to grow, or the market is more likely to grow if there's one standard platform that everybody uses, right? So there's kind of an issue of standards and compatibility, just like, you know, with, a USB, the USB cable or your USB thumb drive, right? It's better for the thumb drive industry if all thumb drives have the same connector so that you can use any brand of thumb drive on any device that has a USB port. You know, that's better for the development of thumb drives than it would be if you had a proprietary storage technology like Apple has, FireWire and this sort of thing, that's not industry standard. And so it's better for the development of the industry if you have a commonly agreed upon standard. So the preferences of the players, Mises Institute and Krugman Institute, are as follows, right? The Mises Institute's, the best of all possible worlds for the Mises Institute are a world in which both the Mises Institute and the Krugman Institute use Google Hangouts. Okay, you might want to write that down. So the Mises Institute's number one, best state of affairs, best possible outcome is everybody uses Google Hangouts. The second best for the Mises Institute is that everybody use WebEx. Okay? Again, for whatever reason, Danny likes Google Hangouts better than WebEx, but he could use WebEx if he has to. Right? So we really like Google Hangouts better, but we'd rather have everybody on the same platform to promote the development of the online education market. Right? So Mises Institute's first choice is we use Google Hangouts, and Krugman Institute uses Google Hangouts. Mises Institute's second choice is both organizations use WebEx, but our third and fourth choices are the ones in which the market is fragmented, right? So Mises Institute's third choice is the one where we use Google Hangouts and Krugman uses WebEx, and our fourth choice would be the one in which we use WebEx and Krugman uses Google Hangouts. Okay, and suppose that Krugman's preferences are symmetric. The same thing, except that he prefers WebEx, right? So top choice for Krugman is both institutes use WebEx. Second choice for Krugman is both institutes use Google Hangouts. Third choice for Krugman is he uses WebEx, we use Hangouts. Fourth choice for Krugman, we use WebEx, he uses Hangouts, okay? So everybody wants both sides want their preferred technology to win, but they both prefer a unified standard than a fragmented market. If any of you have ever studied, the old example of VHS versus Betamax, or HD DVD versus Blu-ray, maybe competing platforms for USB or whatever. There are lots of examples of standard-setting games that are described in this way. The generic category for this game is what's called the Battle of the Sexes. If you want to just do a Google search for Battle of the Sexes game. Again, I'm not going to draw the diagram or do the math, but intuitively you can see that there are two possible equilibrium outcomes, the one in which we both use Hangouts and the one in which we both use WebEx. Right? So both of those meet the Nash equilibrium criteria. If I'm using Hangouts and Krugman's using Hangouts, well, I certainly wouldn't rather switch to WebEx if I knew Krugman was going to use Hangouts. And Krugman, even though he doesn't like Google Hangouts, if he knows I'm using Google Hangouts, he's better off using Google Hangouts than WebEx so we have a standard platform. So that meets the criteria for Nash equilibrium. Same thing where we're both using WebEx. Neither one of us would want to switch if we knew the other was using WebEx. And if the market is split, well, then both of us would want to switch, right? If I knew he's using WebEx, I'd rather use WebEx. If he knows I'm using Hangouts, he'd rather use Hangouts, and so forth. So there are two Nash equilibrium in this game. How do you know which one would obtain? Well, here's where we can make an interesting twist to the game. Right? Suppose instead of the Mises Institute choosing its platform and the Krugman Institute choosing its platform simultaneously, meaning each of us makes a choice independently without knowing what the other has chosen. Suppose instead we can do it in sequence, right? What if the Mises Institute can choose its technology first, and then the Krugman Institute has to come along second and figure out what to do. Well, naturally, we would use Google Hangouts, our preferred technology. So Krugman comes along. We've already played, right? We've already made our selection. Now, Krugman can choose WebEx and have a split market, or he can choose Hangouts, which is not the one he likes, but he'd rather have a unified market. So he has no choice but to follow along, and he'll simply choose the platform that we prefer. Like, if this is a game in which there is a first mover advantage, if one side can commit to a technical standard before the other side can play, the other side will find it's in their own interest to adopt the standard that the first mover prefers, even if the second mover would rather have had another standard. But then you get to the question of, well, you know, how do we get to move first, right? How do you get a first mover advantage? Again, if we simply made an announcement on our website, we are using Google Hangouts for our course that starts next month, then Krugman can come along the next day and say, oh, well, we're going to use WebEx for our classes that start at the same time the next month. And then we're back to the sort of simultaneous move over the sequential version. Right? In other words, Krugman, even though we made our announcement a day earlier, he might think we're just bluffing. It might be like my promise to take the Xbox away for a year. How can the Mises Institute make a credible commitment to one platform so that Krugman knows it really has little choice but to go along? Well, that's where we have to do something other than simply making an announcement, engaging in so-called cheap talk. We have to do something publicly and visibly that commits us to a particular course of action so that we could not change our mind even if we wanted to. For example, you know, sign a contract with Google or some provider of Google Hangout specific equipment and post and make that contract public. You know, where there are big damage provisions. Hey, you know, look, Paul, I'd like to switch to WebEx, but I've already signed a contract for Google Hangouts and I can't get out of it even if I wanted to. And you can see that by looking at the contract. I can't switch. You know, you're just gonna have to go along with Google Hangouts. Right? Or I make some kind of investment, again, a public investment, a lot of equipment and technology and training that can only be used for Google Hangouts, the value of which would be lost if we were to adopt WebEx. Maybe the most famous example of credible commitment, maybe some of you heard this story of the Spanish explorer Cortez, right, arriving in the New World and proceeding to burn all of his ships. You guys know this story, right? The idea was, well, Cortez burned his ships to make a signal to his soldiers that they were not going to leave. Hey, you know, if you guys want to survive until the next ships come a year from now, you're going to have to go into the jungle and fight and fight the indigenous people and seize the gold and do what I want. You know, you can't chicken out. We can't retreat and go back home, even if we wanted to, because the ships are gone. Right? So burning the ships is a good example of a credible commitment. And notice, you know, he couldn't just quietly dismantle the ships at night and have it work. It had to be very public. His men had to see him do it so they would believe when he said, hey guys, we're not leaving, he wasn't just bluffing, he really meant it. Okay, again, you could go online and find lots of math to go through coordination games and these standard setting games, and that's fine. I encourage you to do that if you're so inclined. But the basic logic, the concepts of credible commitment, the idea that sequence might matter, the idea that sometimes we want to coordinate and sometimes we want to compete with our rival, the idea that we have to sort of put ourselves in our rival's shoes and try to anticipate what would my rival do if he were in my shoes. That's the key to this strategic thinking, right? Trying to anticipate other people's moves and counteract those moves either in advance or after the fact, right? That's the sort of habit of thought that you want to develop, and game theory might be useful as a tool of developing those habits, but by no means is it strictly necessary. Okay, again, apologize for the technical delay and for running over. Let me see if I can address any of these questions quickly. There's lots and lots of really excellent questions here. Those of you who want to stick around. Good movies being suggested for us. Movies are always good for understanding these kind of concepts. Let's see. How about of course, yeah, Krugman, what a silly example. Silly hypothetical. Let's see. I'm looking for a question that I can easily answer. And gosh, I've done such a great job explaining everything that there are no questions I can answer. Let's see. First rule of any game is to know you're in one. Yeah, I mean, that's actually a profound point. This is from Lou. I mean, the way I would put it is maybe thinking through game theory, you know, with these kind of models. I mean, maybe it helps to clarify the situation that you're in. You know, not only am I in a game, but what game am I in? You know, who are the other players? Who are the other firms or entrepreneurs whose actions have a significant effect on my well-being? Right? If I'm Coke, is it just Pepsi? Is it also makers of other beverages? Is it SodaStream? Is it Starbucks? Are they players or not? You know, what do I think are the preferences of the different players? What do I think they would rather see? And how can I use that to my advantage? You know, what's the structure of our outcome, of our interaction? Do I have a chance to grasp a first mover advantage? Or am I in a kind of situation, maybe because of strong uncertainty, where it's better to let somebody else move first and me move second? There may be second mover advantages as well as first. So maybe using these concepts will help us to kind of analyze situations that we're in and figuring out what's going on, you know, and what we should do. Here's a question from Jared. How would I feel if the students talked as much as everyone here chats? Gosh, I don't know. Yeah, it would be bad if they were actually disturbing me, but if there were a way they could do it where I didn't hear, I think it'd be great. So, yeah, sorry, Jared is just making a comment that this is a really cool format for teaching because, you know, not only is there some distance so I can't throw an eraser at you if you make me mad, but also you guys can chat amongst yourselves and it doesn't disturb me at all. Let's see. Okay, there's lots of comments about the prisoner's dilemma. There's a question about, you know, how to think about the payoffs in a prisoner's dilemma game. You know, again, I think it kind of depends on the situation, and you wouldn't want to take them too literally. I mean, you know, for the prisoner's dilemma to work, quote unquote, in other words, to get the standard Nash equilibrium in the one-shot game, it has to be the case that, you know, the payoff to me from defecting when the other guy cooperates is higher than the payoff to me from cooperating when the other guy cooperates, and so forth. So there's a range of possible numbers that could go in there. Does it make sense to think of those as corresponding to levels of well-being or something? I mean, again, if you want to say that and say that these are payoff numbers or utility numbers, I'm not going to jump on you and say, no, you can't do that because of ordinal utility. Yeah, as long as you only mean that, you know, I prefer this, you know, 5 is bigger than 3, and that's just a shorthand way of saying I prefer the thing that gives me 5 to the thing that gives me 3. Now, if you want to say, well, you know, I prefer the outcome that gives me 6 exactly twice as much as I prefer the thing that gives me 3, then I'm going to have – I don't think we could do that, right, because preference is just relative rankings, not absolute ones. Sometimes you see these games where people put, you know, revenue numbers in the boxes. I mean, that can be okay if the revenue numbers correspond to the ultimate objective of the players. I mean, they might not, right? I mean, you're trying to maximize profit, not revenue. I've seen some examples where students will say, yeah, but you know, if I'm Coke, I might choose a move in a game that gives me a lower payoff than I would if I took some other move, if that hurts the other guy even more than it hurts me. I mean, that's fine. I mean, there may be situations where you do want to do something that hurts the other guy more than it hurts you. There's a whole literature on so-called raising rivals' costs. You see a lot of that in regulation. You know why Walmart often lobbies in favor of stricter health and safety regulations for workers and stricter enforcement of rules about handicapped parking spaces and so forth. And that's a cost to Walmart. It increases Walmart's costs, but it increases Walmart's costs by less in proportionate terms than it increases the cost of mom and pops? The answer is, yeah, that's fine. I mean, game theory can handle that just fine. You want to make sure that the numbers that are in the cells or at the different branches of the tree correspond to what the different players actually want or prefer. So revenue numbers may or may not be okay, but whatever numbers you put in, they're supposed to fold all that other stuff in. There's a question about the customer's preferences. Yeah, I mean, again, Jason, the idea here is, no, of course the customer's preferences are the ultimately matter. That's all that matters, right? Otherwise, we don't get any revenues. It's just that the payoff numbers that go in these boxes are supposed to incorporate anything that affects the well-being of the decision maker. So if we're modeling a game between Coke and Pepsi, then consumer preferences enter into it only in the sense that they affect Coke's revenues when Coke price is high and Pepsi price is low, Pepsi's revenues when Coke price is high, Pepsi price is low, and so forth. If we want to think explicitly about how the consumers might react, right? If we want to make the consumers a player in the game as well, of course, there's no reason we can't do that. It's just a different game. Then we can't draw a 2x2 matrix with Coke and Pepsi as the two players, right? Maybe it's a three-player game between Coke, Pepsi, and cola drinkers. Maybe there are four players or five players or 100 players. Again, the more players in the game, the less useful these kinds of analytical techniques will be to make it interesting or to get some insight out of it. Okay. Okay. Lou's asking a great question about Ronald Coase, but I think I'm going to save that for next week. Next week we'll be talking about firm boundaries, and I'll be drawing a lot on Ronald Coase's work and making some critiques of Coase. Then we have 2 weeks after that on internal organization, which will include incentive compensation and sort of organizational design, delegation, and decentralization. But we'll stop for tonight. We're already over our allotted time. Again, our apologies for the technical difficulties. We will get it worked out between now and next week so that doesn't happen again. And let's continue this discussion in the discussion rooms, discussion threads on Moodle. And please shoot me an email if you have a question about anything that was not addressed there. Okay, thanks a lot, everybody. See you later.